Okay, so today I'm going to talk to you about another kind of working relationship between humans and animals, that of the working relationship between the early modern English witch and the animal familiar. I'll quickly explain just exactly what the animal familiar was. The animal familiar was believed to have been a demonic helper for the witch, who would enact her malice and revenge upon any neighbours who had caused her any displeasure for whatever reason, no matter how minuscule. The familiar was normally depicted as either an emissary of the devil or as the devil himself. Witch hunting, and therefore beliefs about the animal familiar, were most prevalent in England during the 16th and 17th centuries, and will be thus the period I'm going to focus on today. The animal familiar came to the witch in two main ways. Firstly, it was normally passed on to the witch by a family member, either upon death or when they want to kind of recruit them as a witch, or the devil would gift the familiar to the witch himself. That it was a working relationship lay at its very centre, and is reflected in the Witchcraft Act of 1604, which lists the relevant crimes that come under the umbrella of witchcraft, that included those who did entertain, employ, feed or reward any wicked or evil spirit. What is most important here concerning the animal familiar were the ideas that people believed about the creature, as revealed to us through the legal documentation left behind, as well as the pamphlets that were printed in order to entertain and inform the general population about the doings and ongoings of these evil and wicked women. The reality of what was really going on is obviously a very different matter entirely and isn't something I'm going to talk about today because it is a whole topic on its own. It's necessary to briefly note that the animal familiar almost always appeared in the form of a real animal and not of a fantasy creature. The most prevalent forms of cats, dogs, mice, rats, moles, and toads were all notable in their normality. This is perhaps most central to the familiar because it is familiar. It didn't often take the form of an unusual or imaginary animal, and it fit neatly within early modern lives. Most crucially, however, is what the accused witch would confess herself about the familiar. Many of the beliefs presented here come to us via these confessions, and I'll start by looking at the requests that the witch and the familiar made of each other, and through which we can achieve an understanding of their working relationship. Much as a working animal would perform activities for their human master, but in exchange would receive food or shelter, the demonic relationship between the witch and the familiar is pretty much the same. Although in some of the earlier cases in the 16th century, the familiar fed on the witches, the familiar was fed food such as beer, bread, milk. By the 17th century, we get the much more famous kind of idea that the familiar would feed on the witch's blood. The cat familiar of Elizabeth Francis of Chelmsford in Essex, accused in 1566. This is a picture of her cat familiar from when she was apprehended a second time and was printed in a 1579 pamphlet, which is quite unfortunate for her. Was said to have received a drop of blood every time that he did anything for her. Similarly, we have Elizabeth Style of Rockingham in Berkshire, who was accused in 1579 and was said to have sent her familiars out to attack her targets and for their hire would give them a drop of her own blood. This particular relationship, however, didn't just involve Elizabeth feeding the familiar, but the familiar feeding Elizabeth as well. For one section of her confession included her having gone to Windsor to beg for milk, which she failed to procure, and upon returning home to her rat familiar Philip, had provided her with both milk and cream. We see with Elizabeth's relationship, therefore, that though the witch was considered to have hired the familiar and in exchange would supply the creature with her blood, the familiar would also ensure that she was provided with food when necessary. We can also find occasions where the familiar made particular requests of the witch, and these should also be considered because they show us that the relationship was not a straightforward case of the accused witch simply having used the familiar to attack her enemies, but that the familiar itself was considered to have had an active relationship and an active role in this relationship with its own wants and interests. The familiar was primarily shown to have been driven by a desire to spread mischief, and by exploring these requests made of the witch, we can better understand their working relationship. Although a large number of these requests were for payment in the form of blood or food, emphasising this employment aspect, we can also find other types of requests. Many of these involved the not too small cost of the witch's very soul in exchange for the use of the familiar's services. Now, this was an important part of early modern witchcraft beliefs throughout Europe, where the devil would secure a pact or covenant with the witch in order for her then in turn to become a witch. But in England, many of these pacts were secured by the animal familiar. One such typical request was presented to Ellen Greenleaf in Barton in Suffolk, who was accused in 1645, who upon her meeting her familiars claimed that a mole spoke to her with a great hollow voice and asked her to give her soul and body to him, for he could save her, and bid her not to be afraid of him, for he could perform what he promised, whereupon she consented. Aside from the requests for payment or for the pact, the main other type of request that the familiar made of the witch was permission for the familiar to perform its acts of malice. We see within these requests that, despite whatever else this relationship could be from the perspective of the witch, the familiar was presented as always focused on its primary goal of serving the devil's agenda. On rare occasions, familiars were said to have sought the witch's permission to attack a particular target. Marie Sexton from Suffolk, accused in 1645, claimed that her dog familiar had asked her whether she wanted to have revenge upon the constables that had carried her to Ipswich, but she refused to allow this to happen. Accused witches were most often said to have sent their familiars to attack their neighbours, which is most likely consistently recorded because this is the act that brought the witch to the attention of the legal system. Attacks on neighbours formed a crucial part of the relationship between the witch and the familiar. We have here Marjorie Smith of Battle in Sussex, who was accused in 1565 and was said to have sent her two toad familiars to kill a cow belonging to a John Foster. These attacks on livestock continued and can be found throughout the 17th century. We also have Jane Wiggins of Harwich in Essex, accused in 1611, who was said to have sent her two bird familiars to attack a man's horse because he wouldn't give her any yeast to make beer, and so the horse was struck and killed by her birds. Later still, in 1645, we have the details of the dangerous snail familiars of John Bysack of Wardingfield Magna in Suffolk. These snails were named Sidrake, Geoffrey, Peter, Aylward, Sackar, and Pyman, each of which was said to have specialised in attacking a different type of target. So the first was to kill all manner of fowls, which was the first he confessed he employed. The second was to kill sheep and such like cattle. The third, hogs and such like. The fourth, cows and such like beasts. The fifth, all manner of horses. And the sixth, Christians. And so, particularised many mischiefs he had done. The animal familiar therefore attacked the traditional and more productive working relationship by attacking livestock as well as Christians in this manner. These tasks, however, were not limited to attack on livestock and humans. Elizabeth Francis, again, of Chelmsford in Essex, was said to have requested her familiar's assistance in inducing an abortion. Frances was reported to have been doubting herself with child, and willed Satan, her cat familiar, to destroy it, and he bid her to take a certain herb and drink, in which she did, and destroyed the child forthwith. That of Familia was considered to have been the one to have procured the necessary herbs to achieve this abortion can perhaps add to our understanding of their relationship, because it wasn't an act of revenge, for Frances was shown to have sought this abortion as a result of having earlier sought the attention of an Andrew Biles with the assistance of her cat Familia Satan. Biles, however, would not marry Frances after this Andrew had thus abused her, and so she sent her familiar to not only waste his goods, but also willed him to touch his body, which he forthwith did, and whereof he died. We see here, although destruction and a pain came as a result, the familiar initially did seek to assist the witch in improving her life, although we can see that he did fail miserably by not ensuring that Biles married Frances. Here, the relationship appears to have been quite complicated, with the familiar's actions having made the witch's life much more difficult, and thus the familiar tempted the witch into trouble for herself, disguised as help. Despite everything that the familiar offered to the witch, she wasn't more happy or more comfortable in her life for having used its services, and for entering into the pact. We also see that the requests made of the familiar became more exclusively dangerous as the period progressed. Although the familiar seems to have always been given instructions to harm people and livestock, in the 16th century we more regularly see descriptions of the familiar disrupting, say, the brewing process than we find in the 17th century. Agnes Waterhouse of Chelmsford in Essex, another owner of the cat familiar Satan, sent her familiar to destroy the brewing of her target, but when she begged for butter from another person and was refused, she also sent Satan to destroy the curds of the woman's butter. In 1589, we have Joan Prentice of Sybil Headingham in Essex, who was said to have fallen out with the wife of a William Adams, and so asked her ferret familiar to spoil the drink that Adams's wife had been brewing. Although these details seem to have fallen out of favour, no doubt overshadowed by much more pressing matters of the familiar attacking people and livestock, they did on occasion appear in later documents. Jane Linstead of Suffolk in 1645 was said to have sent one of her imps to hinder a baker from baking his bread. The familiar's malice, therefore, included the damaging of the livelihoods of the targets of the witch. How the familiar and the witch interacted with each other is also a central part of their relationship. Despite the familiar's propensity for causing harm and pain, we have an alleged comment from Elizabeth Clark of Manningtree in Essex, who was asked by the witch hunter Matthew Hopkins during the infamous 1645-7 East Anglian witch hunt, as to whether her familiars would do her any harm. Clark responded with, "Did you think that I am afraid of my own children?" We see here that the relationship could certainly be portrayed in a positive manner. Yet whilst some sources depicted the witch and the familiar as united in purposeful malice, others showed the accused witch conceding to the accusations against her whilst attempting to reframe those same accusations in order to show herself as an unwilling participant. Although these particular interactions present us with beliefs about the witch having been pressured into her crimes, they also reinforce the very violent nature of these animals. Aubrey Grinsett, alias Thrower of Dunwich in Suffolk, accused in 1665, provides us with a particularly detailed example of this type of reluctant witch. When she discussed why she sent her familiar to attack someone, Grinsett stated that she did bear him no ill will, but it was against her will. She could not help it. The devil would let her be at no quiet till it was done. Grinzer expanded further upon her reluctance in her confession, where she stated that if it were possible, she would never send her imp again, adding, "Oh, that I could not. It would be more happy for you and more happy for me." We can find many more examples of the familiar depicted as the one pressuring the witch, particularly during the East Anglian witch hunt, with John Lowes of Branston in Suffolk in 1645, who stated that these imps did force him to employ them about some evil action. Similarly, a man referred to as Cherry of Thrapston in Northamptonshire in 1647 stated that his imps must be employed, else they would not let him be quiet, but torment him. The familiar was also capable of leaving this relationship if it no longer suited them. In 1649, we have Elizabeth Knott of Norton in Hertfordshire, who was swum. This is the notorious test that if you sink, then you're not a witch, but if you float, then you are a witch. So it's not very nice. When she was in the water, her familiar sucked upon her breast and then left her, never to return. Similarly, we have the mice familiars of Anne Desborough of Bythorn in Huntingdonshire, who was accused in 1645. And they left her once she had been apprehended. The familiar, therefore, didn't necessarily exhibit any loyalty to their witch. Naturally, we can see a practical reason behind this, because there had to be an explanation for why the witch was abandoned once she had been apprehended, and her demonic helper wasn't coming to her in the jail. But it also made sense within familiar beliefs, because this demonic creature had its own agenda, and this wasn't necessarily in the best interests of the witch. The requests made by the familiar of the witch occasionally took an even darker turn. Susanna Smith of Rushmere in Suffolk in 1645, when speaking with the devil in the shape of a red dog, claimed that he had tempted her to kill her children, but she strove with him for 24 hours before he went from her, but she would not kill them. Mary Scrutton was similarly challenged by the devil, this time in either a shape of a bear or a cat. The pamphlet isn't very exact in which one it is, who tempted her in a hollow voice to kill her child. And it wasn't only infanticide, but also suicide that can be found amongst these darker requests made by the familiar of the witch. We have Lydia Taylor of Suffolk in 1645, who confessed that her blackbird and owl familiars counselled her to kill herself. So in conclusion, we can see how the working relationship between the animal familiar and its witch was often a very twisted and bitter one. It was a threat to her community, and it was a threat to the witch's very soul within the religious backdrop of early modern England. Although on the surface, it appeared that the relationship was a united one between a demonic animal and a wicked and evil witch, we can find many incidences where the accused witch depicted herself as desperately denying this insistent and violent animal. In either case, the hierarchy was not that of a typical natural working relationship between a person and an animal. The animal familiar did seek employment, but it had its own agenda. If the witch didn't share this agenda for the spreading of malice and mayhem, then the animal familiar would force her to concede to it via violence. The animal familiar could not be tamed, and its destructive capabilities could only be directed by the witch. Ultimately, the animal familiar, and therefore the devil, were the ones with the power, and the accused witch was simply its pawn. Thank you.